You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Physiology and Healing. It is Collected Works, Volume 314. I am now beginning the third part of this, which is entitled Aspects of Therapy. And the first lecture in this third part is Lecture 10 in the collected work of this volume, given in Dornach on the 31st of December, 1923. It is good to know that you have already stated what you would like us to consider, and we'll start with those requests. I hope the three sessions at our disposal will permit us to cover it all. In these few sessions, I would wish to talk to you truly as things arise from anthroposophy, so that we won't concern ourselves with the current terminology of another field, but concentrate on the subject matter as requested, the way it can arise from anthroposophy. The first question raised, and other things can no doubt also be covered by this, at least in principle, was about syphilitic conditions. So far we have not said much about these. They have to be carefully distinguished from all kinds of sequels, concurrent phenomena, and so on, and really point most intensively to the organism's behavior in sickness. The luetic or syphilitic phenomena are a significant issue in medical theory and practice, for without doubt, let us speak without any prejudice, you will see that we do not wish to stop at prejudices for this reason. Mercury treatments are the specific for them. Yet it is exactly the study of mercury treatments which will help us to realize how the problem may be dealt with in a more appropriate way. Essentially, every illness is due to lack of harmony in the way the three systems in the human organism work together. The study of these systems, the neurosensory system, the rhythmic system, and the system of limbs and metabolism, is much more important than even physicians think today. Just consider what this harmonious interaction rests on. In the system of metabolism and limbs, we have an activity of the human organism that proceeds above all in conjunction with the etheric body. But the other aspects of the human organism also have an influence on each of the systems. Thus we cannot say that the two aspects of the human organism, the physical and the etheric organism, are acting together in the system of metabolism and limbs. They are merely the principal agents. The others have an influence, the astral body and the capital I organization. In the organization of the head, that is, in the whole neurosensory organization, the situation is that the I organization and astral organization are the main influences, and in a more subordinate way, also the etheric organization and the physical organization. Above all, we must clearly understand that the difference between the waking and the sleeping state is that in the latter, with the organism showing a kind of inertia, the activities coming from astral organism and I organism continue on, in a way, activities which in the waking state have a direct influence. They continue as an after echo in the sleeping state, when the astral body and I organization are absent. Can we understand this? The actions continue on, just as when I give a ball a push and it will roll on even when no longer pushed. And this is how the activities of the astral body and I organization continue to be effective in sleep. It would thus be wrong to say of anything derived from the I organization or the astral organization that they could not be present in sleep. Sleep merely has to end when there is a danger of the astral after activities or I after activities, coming to an end. That is the moment when sleep must end again, and the waking state arise. But these things cannot be taken in the schematic form in which they sometimes have to be presented in anthroposophy to help lay people to understand. Here we must truly present the facts as they are. All those many questions as to the causes really should, in the main, relate not to the internal organization of the organism, but rather the way things are brought about from outside. This is something we should always know. We should always make the diagnosis such that it is a complete case record. Speculation about causes in the organism does not really help one to find the medicinal agents in the right way. If I put the question like this, I have to say, what is the actual situation with syphilis? Let us consider syphilis on its own, leaving aside anything which might also be sexually transmitted disease, gonorrhea, cankers, and so on. Everything, therefore, with which essentially, we'll consider it separately later, is not connected with syphilis, but essentially a different disease. Syphilis as such essentially is due to the human eye organization being in demand too much for the system of metabolism and limbs, mainly the metabolic system, therefore. In a way, the human eye organization slides down into the pelvic region, and all the symptoms which develop are due to the eye organization sliding down excessively into the pelvic region. This gives rise to all the processes reflected in the familiar symptoms, processes resulting in preponderance of the eye organization over the etheric organization, which should not be present in this tract in the human organism. The eye organization is simply too powerful in the sexual tract. These are the facts. We must first consider these facts, and not so much the infection, and so on, for the facts are there, and the cure must really be based on these facts. Let us consider the effects of mercury treatment. What happens in the human organism with any mercury treatment? As you know, this is a very old method of treatment, and on occasion extraordinarily useful in treating not only syphilis, but also other conditions. But what happens with mercury treatment? Mercury is one of the medicinal agents that was considered beneficial in times when medicine was instinctive and far-reaching, used on the basis of a certain instinctive insight into the human organism. But what brings about healing when you have to have mercury treatment for syphilis? Exactly as much of the mercury preparation, incorrect dosage, as is introduced into the blood, will heal. The exact amount does it. Consider the consequences. In the first place, it is not the custom, so far as I know, to give mercury by injection to treat syphilis. People have started to do so in recent years, as the earlier ointment treatments are no longer so effective, or too effective. But all in all, even this partial change came about empirically, because people realized that the ointment had aspects that lead to problems. What is going on? If you use the ointment, it will essentially lead to partial, and indeed general, infection. It is designed for all of it to enter into the bloodstream. But when you apply the ointment, the mercury impulse also follows other lines in the human organism. The part which enters into the blood will cure. Any that does not get into the blood but follows etheric pathways, is carried along etheric pathways that run along the nervous system, the nerve strands, for instance, creates problems. All of it spreads the eye organization through the whole organism, as it were. And essentially, you merely get the problem spread over the whole organism in a different form. The internal processes which prepare for this go on for years, and then all the phenomena appear, which are the sequels of the mercury treatment. We may say, therefore, that the treatment of syphilis with mercury shows the actual medicinal action of mercury. What is it based on? The subject matter can today be spoken of in quite general terms, as I did yesterday in the general lecture. From a certain moment onward, the organic substances are no longer under the influence of the earth's forces, but under the influence of cosmic forces acting from the periphery toward the center of the earth. The point is that from a certain moment onward, everything we receive into the organism via our ordinary digestion, once it has passed the intestine, is under the influence of cosmic powers, powers that round things off, real cosmic powers that round things off. The eye organization mainly lives in these cosmic powers. If it intervenes too much in the metabolic system, the eye organization simply shows the tendency to atomize, to round off individual elements in the human organism, organizing them, rather than to organize whole body through and through in its form, the whole body through and through in its form. All the signs of syphilis, all the symptoms of syphilis, result from this partial atomizing, this atomistic organizing process. The eye organization intervenes in truly very small systems in the human organism, systems that should be left for the ether body to organize, which alone is subject to the peripheral cosmic forces directly, and not via the eye organization. Mercury has the peculiarity that, introduced into the human organism, it is under earthly conditions the substance which, for itself, imitates the outer form of the cosmos most intensively. The moment we introduce mercury directly into the bloodstream by injecting it, the tendency develops to hand this partial organization, this small-scale atomistic organization, over to the mercury. The eye organization is then free again, active everywhere in the organism, and able to restore the state of health by reaction. All this does, however, depend on the patient never having more mercury in him than is absolutely necessary. It is a problem which can never be solved. For when giving mercury treatment, you must never run the risk of giving even just a little too much. You must give exactly as much as can be taken up into the bloodstream according to the current status of the disease, for any excess remains as a residue and causes the sequels which are familiar to you. So, you will always find that mercury treatment cures the patient, you will always find that mercury treatment cures, but the patient may often have to pay a truly heavy price for this, with the terrible sequels, which also look like syphilis, but really must gradually and irrevocably destroy the organism. The very fact of mercury being a certain cure shows us that its use is highly problematical. It was not always problematical. You see, not exactly syphilis, but various other conditions were always treated with mercury. We may perhaps talk about this on one of the next days. Mercury actually provoked a quite specific emotive reaction in the sick, who were gifted with instinct. The patient would know when he had enough. He would be sated with mercury. The instincts have degenerated now. Patients can no longer provide the standard for what happens to them through mercury. They are no longer sated with mercury, but overfed with it. This is generally the situation today. Patients are more than sated with mercury, and the devastating sequels then develop. Just as we can clearly see the action of sulfur and phosphorus in the organism, and what happens in the organism when salt dissolves, though one must always be careful about the dosage, so we can see it in the case of mercury. We know the basis on which mercury acts. The question is, would it be possible to give such treatment so that it does not harm, even if the dosage is too high, because elimination to the outside would deal with the excess? Mercury has the peculiarity that it is not eliminated to the outside when too much is applied to the body. It is eliminated to the inside. In this respect, it was extraordinarily important to me, when I was young, to see Hertel simply take the bones of people who had had mercury treatment at the post-mortem, knock one against the other, and one could then see the small droplets of mercury in those bones under the microscope. Footnote, trying to pronounce the name Hertel, readers aside, spelled H-Y-R-T-L, and I'm pronouncing that Hertel, end of readers aside. The whole skeletal system was full of mercury. This is the peculiarity of mercury. It is not eliminated to the outside. The organism takes it up. And in someone who has had mercury treatment, the whole eye organization is all the time involved in organizing these tiny mercury droplets, mercury atoms, which are present everywhere in the organism, and especially in the calcified parts. It is fair to say that we must try and find something in the realm of nature that is taken up by the organism when mercury is used, and takes the place of the eye organization to relieve it and set it free. Yet if you give too much of it, which is inevitable, it must be eliminated not to the inside but to the outside, like anything else that gets digested. We must find something which in the natural world outside corresponds to eye nature, and where it may be possible to process it so that it actually enters into the bloodstream, evoking a phantom, as it were, of the eye organization in the bloodstream. What we have to do is to put an artificial eye into the bloodstream. Our physicians in particular should do the relevant experiments. You will, without doubt, see results that will certainly be surprising. Take material obtainable from plant parts that show extraordinary hardening with the root process applied to the rest of the plant. In the root process of a plant, we have an extraordinarily great imitation of the eye organization. The flower is etheric in organization. In the parts below the flower, the astral organization is playing around the plant. The eye organization comes in where the plant is rooted in the soil. In very woody roots, which, however, are still part of the plant, and have not been separated from the plant and grown inorganic, we have impulses of the eye organization. It will not, however, be possible to take plant roots, extract substances, and inject them. The reason is that the plant root does very much contain the eye organization, being a phantom of the eye organization, as it were, but the impulses living in the root are limited to the neurosensory system and do not act strongly down into the rest of the organization. We may say, therefore, that when the root organization is taken as root only, you will hardly be able to produce a preparation for the above-mentioned purpose. There are plants, however, where the root organization has a powerful influence on the whole plant. Such a plant where the root organization penetrates the whole plant as far as the fruit is Astrolagus excapus, heart's milk vetch. Its fruits look like pods, but are rock hard and contain grains. I am referring to something which is completely cornified, as it were. Or take certain types of wood which are in fact used, and the action of which is based on the principle I have been presenting. We have to take the seed grains from a plant such as heart's milk vetch, grind them finely, and then treat them with the plant's sap from the flowers and leaves of the same plant. This gives us a preparation that may perhaps be taken to the third decimal. Injected in the third decimal, it will introduce this phantom of the eye into the bloodstream, and in a case of syphilis that has affected the whole blood, we will, under the influence of this preparation, have exactly the same picture as with mercury treatment. We must then ensure that the excess is driven out with hyperthermic baths, We must thus combine two things, injection with a preparation of this kind, and then driving out the excess with hyperthermic baths. Something else will also come out. The harmful substances in the blood of syphilis patients will come out. This must happen through the discharge of sweat. We therefore have to say that sweating is the only way of getting out the things that must be got out. But these must first be held on to, and this can be done with this rounding off action of the impulses in the heart's milk vetch seeds. So you see, we can really only manage such things by bringing diagnosis and treatment closely together. Individualization is absolutely essential in medicine. It is easy to observe that with forms of syphilis in particular, the syndrome is completely different for an obese person and a lean one. With an obese person, it will be extraordinarily difficult to get the syphilis poison out of the body. I don't know if anyone present today has experience in this. The syphilis poison is harder to get out if the individual is obese compared to someone who is lean. The latter kind of person will have the poison come away relatively easily. With a lean individual, you will probably manage well by using the method I have given. You must make sure, however, that there is a reaction, that perspiration is massive. Otherwise, you will get all kinds of internal diseases as sequels, for the disease process will then not take its course. There has to be a reaction. It may well be that you have to take other measures as well to get the same result with obese patients. It will be a very good thing to turn to something which in nature, too, has come up more into the astral process. It will be a good thing in certain cases, where you see no reaction with the usual plant, to use plant galls. I spoke of them in a different context yesterday. In plant galls, the etheric roundness is already there. The gall shows you mercurial nature in the vegetable realm. If you process it by trituration, adding a very small dose of the venom of the wasp, which caused the gall to develop in the process, this will give you a very effective medicine, which provides a reaction also in situations where it is difficult to get a reaction. The situation with us is that we really have far too few cases which we can observe step by step. I would imagine that our friends, who are physicians, do not exactly consider it to be the ideal to bring syphilis patients into their institutes. But things like this cast a light on the whole of therapy altogether. We really learn something for the whole of therapy from such a treatment. And I am also convinced that once someone has seen how the skin of a patient who has had the injection and the bath looks different when he gets out of the bath, taking a more subtle look, we might perhaps use a microscope, the skin looks as if it had tiny holes everywhere, like very small pustules almost. We see how the organism is affected by something like this. I believe this is the route to be followed in treating syphilis. You see, with this disease in particular, it is necessary not merely to see to it that one helps the patient and then discharges him, but also that one sees to it that the patient sustains the cure as life goes on. This brings me to a question that has also been asked and will be of great interest to most of you. Meditation to accompany medical treatment. Are there any typical suggestions available for this? I am referring to syphilis specifically in connection with this question, for syphilis is the disease which perhaps allows us to answer it most intensely. It is a fact that a syphilis patient who appears to have been cured, every syphilis patient will at first only appear to be cured, for the disease may recur on some future occasion, and every apparently cured syphilis may come up again at a later time. And this will depend on the individual in question having made his organism altogether into something different from that of someone who does not have syphilis. It is a different constitution, and we must seek to maintain this different constitution for the future, otherwise it will simply prove to be too weak in the face of certain attacks from everyday life, with the syphilis recurring. We will, of course, consider the question of meditative treatment only in general terms, but it can be brought in at just this point. With syphilis, the eye organization is making itself independent in a way, something that does not happen with a normal person. The syphilis patient has made this phantom out of his own organism due to the injection, and as a result, his eye organization will be more independent for the rest of his life on earth than that of someone who has never had syphilis. It is more independent, and this must be taken into account. To cure a syphilis patient permanently, you must see to it that he begins to take a great interest in turning some kind of highly abstract thoughts over in his head again and again, meditatively so. You thus have to advise him to think through geometrical or mathematical problems meditatively, over and over again, in rhythmic repetition, so that he will never cease really to continue to make his eye organization abstract in this artificial way. You have to get his thinking used to this, to develop a certain inner constitution. You will therefore really help him by giving this advice. Every morning when you've woken up, consider how a small similar triangle relates to a large one. You have the same angles, different sides. Think this very slowly at first. Same angles, different sides. Then think it a bit faster, then yet faster, and then think it in a way where you are practically no longer able to see it. After that, start to think more slowly again. Thinking at different speeds, arbitrarily, will get him to provide in the right way for this eye organization that has grown independent. This is one such a type of meditation. But wherever you see that the eye organization has grown more independent in some healing process or other, you can try to make it possible for the patient to continue through life with such a meditation. It is just that it has to be applied particularly strongly in the case of syphilis patients. These patients must really be encouraged to provide for their independent eye organization by means of such a meditation done at different beats. Does that make sense? These things take us to other questions that have been put. We will come back to it all again. I merely would like to have the right context which the matter demands. Now there is a question concerning the root of heart's milk vetch. Steiner again. They are pods. You will open them up, and in there are the rock-hard seeds, which must be reduced to a very fine powder. Another question that has been asked does not appear to be connected, but inwardly these things are connected. It concerns the development of glaucoma. I think today glaucoma is practically always treated surgically, except perhaps by the homeopaths. But homeopathy is not yet rational. It will be necessary to understand the background to a phenomenon such as glaucoma. In a sense, from an organic point of view, in terms of the four levels of human existence, physical body, etheric body, and astral body and eye, glaucoma is really the opposite of all possible forms of ear inflammation if we consider the total process of the organism. The two things are almost polar opposites. You have otitis on the one hand and glaucoma-type phenomena on the other. If you simply consider the fact, it is like this. Glaucoma involves a powerful activity infiltrating the vitreous body, substantially constituting it. The vitreous body grows too intensive inwardly where its own substance is concerned. This leads to hypertrophy of vitreous body activity, and that is the real basis of glaucoma. But what happens next? In terms of the general bodily constitution, a sense organ, such as the eye, is just on the point of being sufficiently independent, objectively separated off from the organism as a whole. If it is separated off a bit more than is the case for normal vision, it will be sick, and the organism as a whole can no longer extend its activity to this organ. It is really most interesting to see, especially with glaucoma, how the etheric body, particularly important for the eye, EYE, is present throughout the eyeball, so much so that the physical substance in the vitreous body acts like a physical substance. If it goes beyond the bounds of this, it will act too much as a physical substance. The ether body can no longer reach it, can no longer infiltrate it. We have to see to it, therefore, that the ether body comes into play again, or that physical activity in the eye is toned down. It may be commonplace, but it is true to say, when something like this happens, that the whole of organic activity in this tract of the human organism is simply too weak, partly paralyzed. The activity is too weak and must be spurred on. You can only do this by making exhalation stronger in the human organism than it is in the person with glaucoma at the time when it develops or progresses. If you are able to establish the glaucoma signs and symptoms at the right moment, but the organism sometimes achieves powerful results with regard to such partial diseases, you will get the organism to respond to everything you introduce into it to encourage exhalation, thus stimulating it to increase activity within the head, and you will manage to counteract the activity of glaucoma development. We can achieve this by introducing calcium carbonate from bone ash into the human organism, adding some aerial roots of some kind to it. This gives you a product which regulates respiratory function in the way that is needed in this case. So I mean to say that if we take calcium carbonate from bone ash and introduce it into the human organism, we get the requisite powerful stimulus to exhale. However, to get the organism itself involved and have the activity proceed not sluggishly without the organism, as it were, we have to combine this calcium carbonate with the kind of impulses found in the roots of plants that climb rocks, roots that live in the open air, so that the root element, which otherwise grows in the soil, is taken out into the air. This will make these roots such that their impulses do indeed resemble breathing activity more closely, and we thus have a possibility of getting breathing activity into us. You feel it then. Breathing activity is otherwise stimulated quite involuntarily by calcium carbonate. But if you add the sap from such aerial roots, you have the urge to breathe in like this added. This urge to breathe in like this then strengthens the whole human organization, which you need to balance out what has forcibly left you as the glaucoma developed. Things like this really show that it is always necessary to consider the whole human being. But the physical body is never the whole body. The physical body is always only a part. It is liver, stomach, and so on, and the individual parts are interconnected. The ether body is whole human being to quite a degree, and the astral body is whole human being in a truly magnificent sense. This astral body is, however, organized in a most peculiar way. We might say that the human astral body, as far as the diaphragm, those are approximately the outer limits, is something very different from the astral body below the diaphragm. Astral body activity up toward the head, toward the neurosensory organization, is the complete polar opposite in its activity to that active in the system of metabolism and limbs. Do consider metabolism altogether, which essentially proceeds under the influence of the astral body. Metabolism, as we usually see it, is really an activity of the human organism, where it is only the activity that matters. It is really only the taking up and elimination of substances which matters. We might say that food as such, as substance, does not interest the metabolism at all, but only the overcoming of the outward substantial form of foods and their metamorphosis, not the needs of the organism. Elimination starts immediately in the metabolism itself. Uptake does really immediately become elimination. Only some of it is separated off. And this penetrates as far as the neurosensory organization. With regard to substance, the neurosensory organization is extraordinarily important, for nerve substance is metabolic substance driven to the very end. It may seem grotesque, but in real terms, it is certainly so that the contents of the intestine are nerve substance that has gone only halfway. Nerve substance, especially of the head, is intestinal content processed all the way. Intestinal content transformed by the human organism and especially the eye organization. The contents of the intestines have only gone halfway and are eliminated at that point. The content of nerve substance has been driven to the very end, where it is fully used up and then needs to be processed by the organism. In actual metabolism, the astral organism performs a function which is completely different from its function in the central nervous system. They are absolute polar opposites. This means that the one stops halfway and the other is taken all the way. Between them lies a zero point. It is an absolute fact that polar opposition is complete here. If we were to draw the ether body, it would still be as an ovoid. The astral body can no longer be drawn as an ovoid. It has to be two parts, above and below, their mode of action totally different. Unless you see this, you cannot really understand the human being in health or in sickness. We have to understand that a very different activity takes place in the metabolic sphere compared to that in the nerve sphere. This insight alone makes it possible for us to influence the human organism in a suitable way. If you give preparations made from the volatile oil obtained from a flower, for instance, you do not take them from the lower part of the astral organism into the upper part. They can only be used to evoke some processes or other in the lower part, in the actual metabolic tract. The moment you use anything obtained from the root of a plant, this pushes through from the lower to the upper tract of the astral body, and you have it in there because it acts back again from the head onto the organism. You have it in the whole of the organism. For you must understand that the ordinary way of looking at the composition of the human organism is really most amateurish. You know, people imagine that when, let us say, after a certain time in life, new substance has appeared in some part of the human organism or another, this has come about by way of ordinary metabolism. It means that old substance has been cast off, and the new substance has come about by way of ordinary metabolism. This is how people imagine it to be. I do not think that people who have studied medicine in some way today have a different idea, that some substances or other which are summarily different after a certain time in life have come to be there in any other way but by metabolism, by an exchange. That is not the case, however. If after a certain time of life you find a different substance in some part or other of the human organism, it will never have been secreted along the pathways of ordinary metabolism. Ordinary metabolism only provides the substance for the nervous system, only the internal structure of the nervous system, only the building stones for the nervous system. The activities of the neurosensory system, in conjunction with respiration, then make it possible to take in substances from the cosmic surroundings. The substances are very finely divided and integrated into the organism by the neurosensory organization. In material terms, they replace everything that has been cast off, for things are cast off much more slowly than you think. The human body is thus never made up of the food substances. Nutrition merely maintains the activity which must be there to organize the nervous system. Anabolism, synthesis of matter, does not proceed by the route of nutrition, which is purely imaginary, but really comes in from the cosmos. So if you cut off a nail and it grows again, the material of the new growth does not come from the food, the only role of which is to induce the build-up of the nervous system. The new growth in the human being truly is organic matter substantially replaced, taken up from the cosmos. This does, of course, give one quite a different picture of the way the human being is made up than if one thinks human beings are a kind of hose pipe. Food comes in at one end, exchange takes place in the meantime, and anything which is of no use is separated out. But human beings are not hose pipes. The hose pipe processes happen wholly inside the human organism. The new substance of which human beings are made up again after a certain time of life comes with our breathing and even with subtle absorption into the human organism from the outside world through the senses. The ears are extraordinarily important receptors in this respect, and also the whole sense of awareness, sentience, spread out over the body. Seeing the human being in the right way, we thus have to say to ourselves, right away, that metabolism is internal work in the human organism. The rhythmic organism is also involved in building up the human being, as is the neurosensory organism. Well, we'll continue with this tomorrow and gradually answer the other problems brought to our attention. Do tell me if you would prefer a different way, for the hours we have are but few. I am sure we'll get to the individual problems raised. If any of you have further problems, please let me have them tomorrow. The end of Lecture 10.